Look at the facts. When I graduated from high school 11 years ago, the iPod didn't exist.
Right.
The iPhone didn't exist. Podcasting didn't exist. YouTube was in its infancy. And I would guess 50% of the ways that people earn their income today probably were either in their infancy or didn't exist 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, how on earth could you tell me that you could design for me in 12 years an educational curriculum that is supposed to be able to prepare me for the job skills that I need to function in today's environment? And then what's the most frustrating thing for me is I feel like the older I get and the more I study, the more I feel like everything I learned in school, either A, I forgot it, B, the things that I do remember turn out to be wildly inaccurate upon a further study.
Mm-hmm.
So I almost feel like I was kind of tricked into thinking that I knew something.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Today is October 28th. Wait.
Walking down the street on Halloween night.
Ooh, there we go. And today you will hear part two of my recent conversation with Joshua from Radical Personal Finance. This portion of the discussion is focused on alternatives to and escapes from the government schooling system in America. So that will include talk about private schools, vouchers, Sudbury, homeschooling co-ops, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, media myths about youth. It's all in there. This will probably be the last you hear from me before Keenvention. I want to thank all the people in the School Sucks Facebook group for submitting questions for the media panel hosted by Mark Edge of Free Talk Live. That is Saturday, November 1st at 1:30 p.m. at Keenvention. If you're local, I hope to see you there. And don't forget about our YouTube channel. A lot of my time is spent working on YouTube stuff. So get caught up, if you're not, on the Underground History of American Education series, John Taylor Gatto. There are now 13 of those videos, and number 14 is in the old oven. The last three have dealt with the Prussian connection that we touched on in the first installment of this conversation. So again, check out Joshua at radicalpersonalfinance.com. And here we go. We pick it up like 30 seconds before where we left off last time. We wind up having this weird conversation about Obama at the beginning. So if you want to hear the conversation that was advertised, jump to about the 10-minute mark. You should be very warm at that point. And I mean that, of course, in the sense of getting warmer, getting colder, that old expression. Actual changes in the temperatures of your bodies while you listen to this podcast. None of my business as the host, frankly. I hope it warms you. You know, I hope it warms your little hearts. All right, for real this time, here we go. That was a cat there at the end. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the functions of my show is just to point out this history, but of course also, I think to transition our next subject, what people can do about it and what else is out there.
Right. We live in such a unique time. And I mean, you make a good point about how this is going. I'm interested because I'm watching the Common Core debate happening in the mainstream. And what's interesting to me is in my experience, now again, I'm 29, so I don't have the perspective of decades of watching it, but I've never seen such widespread. If my Facebook feed is any indication, I've never seen such people paying attention to government government schooling in the way that they are now. And so I wonder if Common Core and kind of the implementation of Common Core across the states and the debate that the very tiny debate that's happening about it will make more people go and kind of research it a little bit. It'll be interesting to watch. But
what are your thoughts, in short? What have you gathered so far about it?
About Common Core?
Yeah.
My observation of it is that it seems to be just the continuation of exactly the same agenda that has been around. You know, so for example, exactly of standardization. But because of how kind of bitterly Obama is hated among the conservative Republican faction.
Yeah.
Because of this intense, like, personal, I don't want to be too dramatic, but he evokes very strong very strong opinions from people. And because he evokes very strong opinions, both positive, you know, for him and against him, then because he has been so strong with exerting his political capital against in a very unpopular way, I mean, I feel like just as a layperson observing, I feel like when he rammed through the Affordable Care Act, kind of in face of all opposition, that made a lot of people who would normally just simply say, "Oh, it's no big deal. We're going to, you know, move forward." That made a lot of people stand up and say, "What's going on?" And it started to get people, you know, maybe got started to get people organized against him. And what and I have the problem of being so young that I haven't observed this for decades. But it seems like so many people kind of have started to like research things and study things. And you had that. I just have seen, you know, a reaction against Common Core. And what's interesting is that I judge by my age group. And the interesting thing about my age group, a lot of people that I have conversations with, I've never seen so many of my friends who are not as kind of wacky and out there as I am, you know, in the as far as politically, who are much more mainstream politically. I've never seen so many people kind of paying attention and taking the solutions. And this is why I want to go to solutions, because we live in a time that is such a not an oxymoron. I don't know what the right word is. Not an oxymoron, but it seems so opposed of increasing control over society. And yet it has never been easier to just simply opt out. Like schooling, it is in my study of history of schooling, at least in the last 100 years, it's never really been easier to just simply pull your kids out than it is today. And so we've got a time where people, you know, in, you know, over the course of the next couple of generations, things could radically change. And it's easy. There's no person with a gun simply saying, in most places, there's no person with a gun in the U.S. saying you have to keep your kids in this system. In Germany, there is, but in the U.S., there's not. And so their solutions are simple and straightforward. So that's kind of my answer to your question. If you have insight, I'm interested, because it's such a current political debate.
Well, I think there's obviously been a lot of vitriol in political debate and from opponent to opponent. I think there is an interesting trend really since the second term of Bill Clinton that presidents are getting more hammered by the availability of information in ways they just didn't in the past. I mean, the fact that Nixon went down in the early 1970s, kind of amazing if you think about the lack of information that was available to journalists at the time. And let's cut me off at Nixon right there. That's a story for another time. But I think that Clinton's second term, Clinton gets hammered with a bunch of charges. George Bush is embattled his in both terms. And I think the internet has a lot to do with that. It's only continued with Obama. I think it's all positive trends. I also think, even though I don't like Obama, I don't like his policies, I think he's...
And real quick, I want to interrupt you because... Yeah. I want to interrupt you because it's so important. In our society, it's common that people can't really have many political discussions. So I want to, since I've listened to your show and I know this, I'm a recovering Republican and I'm a devout Christian. Mm-hmm. You all come from a very leftist, Democratic or leftist background, and you're an atheist, right?
I came from a, I fled for sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess I would just say I'm a non-believer in all respect. I don't believe in the political system. I don't believe in the political parties. Maybe it had something to do with my religious upbringing. I don't have a lot of faith in a higher power.
I think religion has destroyed more people of their belief in God than just about any other force. So,
sure. Yeah.
So that's a conversation for another day. But keep going with what you're saying. I just wanted to point that out because people think, especially in listening to a show like this, because my show is not branded as libertarianism. It's not the libertarian radio. Like, you know, I just pointed out that we can all look at it and observe and pull our own decisions. So I interrupted your train of thought, but you were talking about Obama, I think.
Yeah, and I don't like Obama. I don't like his policies. I really see Obama as the embodiment of the progressive movement in many ways, not in every way, but in a lot of ways. The embodiment of the progressive movement from 100 years ago, as far as like, even if he hasn't really been terribly effective in implementing new things outside of the Affordable Care Act or Common Core, what progressives see their role in the management of other people to be. Obama, kind of in his defense, seems to have been this flypaper for everything old conservatives have feared in the last 50 years.
Right.
Blacks,
communists, right. Muslims, like all those labels. Like I heard somebody interview this liberal YouTuber, went out and interviewed people at like some Mitt Romney event. And she's like, Obama goes to Reverend Wright's church and he's a Muslim and he's an atheist. And the guy's like, well, which one is he? And she's like, he's all three. And that's exactly it. He's flypaper for like all these fears, you know, right. that these people have. And they really don't. I see Obama kind of as a pawn, kind of as a dupe, kind of somebody who was guided into this position and animated by idealism. And every time I see him, I just see somebody who's completely defeated by the realities of the presidency. Obviously, pinning everything on Obama as far as all the problems that the country's facing today is really spitting in the face of history. So I try not to do that, but at the same time, you know, not showing any love for Obama. So yeah, I think that with the ever expanding role of the federal government in the public school system, it's important for people to look for alternatives. And I would say the two real alternatives are homeschooling and private school, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people look at these things and they say, I can't do it. Part of that is an attitude problem, right? Homeschooling is a term that I think it opens this door for people to say, oh, I'm not qualified. I can't do school. I have no education in schooling. But if you're living, you're learning. And you have, if you're a parent, you know, you could do home education, right?
Right.
Because, education is just the experience of being alive and interested and motivated. Right. So forget about schooling. No one can do school. As my friend Laurette Lynn says, she's the Unplug Mom. That's her site. And she says, only school can do school. So forget about school. Right. And people that use homeschooling and unschooling, but I like home education. And the guidelines for that, if there are any, I would say, voluntary instruction, right? Kids learn about what they want to learn about. Even if there's like some focus, some subtle focus on things like self-discipline. I think that self-directed learning is the most important and the most valuable piece of education. Learning against one's will is pretty pointless in my estimation, you know, which is based on over a decade of experience, like forcing people to try and do things from gym to algebra doesn't lead to a lot of positive results. And you can even get the illusion of success through like short-term positive results, you know, often in the form of like the school assessments. Like you got a B on the vocabulary quiz. But then how many of those vocabulary words do you remember a month later? You know, I can't tell you how many, like doing SAT vocabulary, how many kids were like, oh, we had this on a quiz a month ago. I was like, oh, great. What does it mean? And they always had the same answer. I don't remember. You know, they just jettison that information. They need to make room for all the other seemingly meaningless stuff they have to learn. So there isn't much, even though you could get this illusion of success in the short term, there isn't much to speak of in the way of retention, motivation, or enthusiasm for learning. And I think the adult society reflects that. What are the best sellers out there? It's things like, you know, here's the easiest way to do something. You know, here's the fastest way to do something. Don't have a lot of self-discipline or, you know, time management skills. Buy this thing. It's already done. Or boredom killers, you know. So
I'll draw it through from financial planning.
Yeah.
Because what happens is, and this was, like I told you earlier, this is how one of the big things that motivated me to go and start studying and try to find info on it. Is people in financial planning, it's very frustrating to be a financial planner because people don't want background. They want the answer. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that you observe is people simply want an expert's opinion. And they don't want to understand why an expert says something. They just simply want to say, what does the expert say to do? And so in financial planning and in personal finance and financial planning, people will often choose their guru. So it's easy to pick on, you know, hi, I'm Dave Ramsey. I'm a Dave Ramsey guru.
Sure.
Or I'm a Susie Orman guru. Or I'm a Jim Crane, or not a guru, a follower.
Yeah.
You know, Dave's my guru. Susie's my guru. You know, Joshua's my guru. And it's so hard to try to help people sever that and say, I'm not your guru. You know, you don't want me to be your guru. I'm your teacher. My hope is that I can earn the place of being your teacher, but I'm not your guru. And you have to exercise a little bit of, you have to work to learn something, and this has to matter to you. And it's very frustrating from the perspective of a teacher, as a financial planner, because what happens, and I think this is what happens to so many times, it's so much harder to teach people how to learn and teach people how to think and give them the background. They just want, many people just want the answer. Give me the answer. Just give me the answer. I can give you the answer. But only if I know everything about you, and I can't give you the answer for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so this has impacted every aspect of life. The schooling, because we've all come through it, it's impacted every aspect of our life. And instead of having the confidence to say, I know how to go and learn the answer, then we're looking for someone to give it to us. In my personal experience, before I started studying any of, you know, Gatto stuff, and at the end here, I'll tell you how I found your show, because it was a very circuitous route. But I didn't go out originally seeking for it. But what I just observed is that the average 3 or 4 year old that I knew was precocious and interested in life and happy and loves learning. I have a 1 year old son and he loves to learn. You can see it. Children love to learn. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed that the average 18 year old that I knew, or even many of the average 30 year olds that I knew, hate learning. And I said, "This is what is wrong here? The only thing that we've effectively done is to taught people to hate learning. And how did this happen? Because I love to learn. I feel like I'm one of the few that escaped. And maybe the reason I escaped was for the first 7 years, with the exception of third grade when I went to a government school, I was educated at home so I could learn about what I wanted to learn about. And I would sit there and read the encyclopedia because I thought it was so interesting to learn about all these things.
Yeah.
So I had a little bit of kind of that built up before I went into a formal school. But I'm ranting a little bit, but if you could step in and help a parent, you know, helping someone like me, I'm in the process of trying to understand how to design my son's, you know, educational plan and what I'm going to hold before him and what I'm not. What would be the guiding principles? You mentioned self-direction and voluntary learning about areas of interest. What other guiding principles would you give to encourage a parent like me?
First of all, I just want to say I really second what you just said, and it was really an important realization for me. You know, even though I had developed a lot of attitudes about, you know, schooling, it was this firsthand experience, and it was probably around 2007, 2008, mm-hmm. where I'm tutoring and I'm working with, you know, the cream of the crop, high school students in Needham, the wealthy community of Needham, Massachusetts, very competitive, you know, all AP kids, and just very generally unmotivated, not curious, feeling like they're just kind of trudging their way through all of these pursuits. At the same time, I'm watching in my own family, my brother's young daughter, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old, and her insatiable curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And this incredible appetite for new information and new experience, and that contrast. And you know, I look at her now, 5 years later, and it's sad. And you know, I wish I could have intervened more, or you know, been more influential in one way or another. It's very difficult to do with other people's kids. She is starting to look more like those 16, 17, and 18 year olds than she looked when she was 3. You know, it was night and day when she was 3.
Right.
But, you know, now I say to her, what's new? What are you doing? And nothing, you know, where's the, you know, device that will distract me from social interaction. So it's frustrating, but all right. So as far as your question is concerned, though, I think that people should first know their options for what exists outside of the government school the mm-hmm. the public school program. Obviously, the first thing is private school. A lot of people might say, I can't do it. I can't afford it. I would investigate voucher programs where you live. Now, mm-hmm. Are you familiar with vouchers?
I am, yes, but go ahead and give a quick overview.
I'm kind of philosophically opposed to the ideas.
Me too.
So of vouchers, because I think they would actually expand state control. But if mm-hmm. people are looking for a quick fix and the system exists and it can help, your child find a better educational experience, it might be for some people something that's worth investigating. Mm-hmm. There's a good resource. It's called Federation for Children, and it's federationforchildren.org. And one of their headings on their page is Ed Choice 101. And you can go and you can maybe search, find out some of the facts, new legislation, what's available mm-hmm. in your state as far as, programs. I do know that it was over 300,000 children participating in private school voucher programs during the last school year. So that's mm-hmm. pretty significant. And people would also be surprised. Private school tuitions are often lower than what the cost is to taxpayers to send someone to public school. Now, obviously, mm-hmm. there's no way out. If you're a homeowner, there's no way out of funding the public school in your district. But if there is a voucher program, that money could be reallocated. It's worth investigating. I mean, my fear with voucher programs is if people can use taxpayer money, which the school establishment and the teachers union see as their money that they earn, and it can be sent to private institutions that would be framed as unaccountable, not having the same rigorous standards as the public system, then we could see expanding state and federal control over private institutions, but we could also see the possibility, and I hope this doesn't sound like a slippery slope argument here, but I think there's also a real possibility that the unions could want to invade private schools and get those people, in their ranks as well.
Yeah, let's leave the voucher conversation there.
Sure.
It's a valuable conversation. And I struggle personally with the question of, is it better to move a little bit in a direction, or is it better to be hardcore? Uh-huh. Do you support something like the voucher program because you say, oh, well, maybe it'll bring people more choice and then that'll allow them to do that? Or do you stick hardcore to principles? I still have never been able to figure out how to settle that.
Yeah.
So, but for the purpose of like today's show, I love talking about the politics of things, but let's leave it check out vouchers. And then one other comment on that, what I'm seeing here, and I'm interested in knowing if you've seen this from a national perspective, I have been finding that here where I live in West Palm Beach, Florida, that some of the charter schools that are coming out are really, not in the mainstream. And so the charter schools are funded. They are official public schools. But what's interesting is that I think many of the teachers that are still involved within the system have looked at and the administrators have looked at things and said, look, this isn't working. So we're going to apply something different. And they've been able to start charter schools. I mean, whether it's the most well-known, different approach would be that in my area, Montessori schools are very popular.
Yeah.
And many of them are tax funded. It doesn't solve the tax funded like political philosophical issue that you and I both share, and the point of theft at the point of a gun, as I would say. Mm-hmm. But ignoring that for a moment and just focusing on solutions, I find that even for parents here locally, there are some charter schools that seem very different than kind of the mainstream industrial school system as it is designed, and maybe that might be a resource for those who aren't ready to go, farther out. What do you think? Are you seeing that across the country?
It's tough to say. I haven't had a lot of faith in charter schools, but I understand it's certainly there's probably a considerable degree of variance from place to place. And I know mostly about what's going on in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Those are the states mm-hmm. where I've lived and worked. So people should my point with the private school thing, or I guess we could add charter schools to that, is people should investigate the options. They should see what the laws are in their area, in their state, and go from there. It would be my third of the three options that I'm going to give. That's number three as far as favorability is concerned. Yeah.
Agreed.
Another private school option that is surprisingly affordable, and more of them seem to be popping up around the country, is Sudbury Schools.
I've never heard of that. What's that?
So Sudbury Schools basically use this self-directed or unschooling model where students have essentially complete responsibility over their own education.
Okay.
The benefit, and I think, and one of the reasons why maybe this is thriving, is that it's a physical location, right, where parents can send their students for essentially an unschooling experience. Now, you're going to pay for it. I mean, I think we went and toured the Sudbury School, the original Sudbury School, actually, which is in, it's near Framingham, Massachusetts, which is outside of Boston. There were things we liked. There were things we didn't like. It was obviously very affordable compared to the cost of Massachusetts public education per pupil, which is approaching probably $20,000 a year.
Wow.
I think their tuition was somewhere around $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a year for Sudbury. Now, obviously, students go there. They decide what to do with their time. And the school is basically managed through a direct democracy where students and staff basically have equal say, right? So hiring and firing of school personnel is actually done by votes that involve students.
Really? Interesting.
I don't love the whole tyranny of the majority thing.
Right. And that makes me uncomfortable too.
There is a curriculum of collectivism going on there, even if it's subtle, right. And I guess it's not so subtle. I think that if people had problem with that aspect of the school, they could counter it with lessons at home, like why democracy is not ideal, why individualism is superior to collectivism. We went and saw the Sudbury School, like I said, and we were just a little antsy around this whole democratic thing.
Right.
The third option would be home education. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people would say, I can't do this. Hey, that's nice if people can do this. I got to work. There are homeschool co-ops that you can investigate. A good resource for that in New Hampshire that I found, newhampshirehomeschooling.org. So I'm thinking most states would have something like that. Unless you live in a state where the homeschooling laws are like really, really strict, you can probably find support groups and resources for the establishment of a homeschool co-op where people kind of all pitch in. Can you do one day a week, of hosting or teaching, depending on what people want to do? But the most important thing for me is that whatever path people choose, that the education is self-directed. So Sudbury or home education are the best ways to achieve that. And I think that's just, of your question, just investigating options is just like the first step to me answering it. What's out there for you?
Right. That idea of a self-directed education is fear-inducing, in my observation, probably the vast majority of the population.
Yeah,
because many of us cannot even conceive of how, if you leave it up to self-direction, then how would they learn anything that matters? How would you address that fear?
I think that's how you learn anything that matters. it's interesting, and I can go into more detail. It goes back to what I was saying, right? Like, learning is living. It's not the controlled environment of the schools. One of the most important things for young children especially is the idea of play. Play is very self-directed, and if you're six, what opportunities do you have for feeling like you're in control of your own life? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Very few. But that's a great way to learn. And I think it kind of goes along with and also encourages another thing that is not being taught to young people, or really more importantly, modeled for young people. And that's the concept of not just this intelligence, like, oh, here's the checklist. Do you know your multiplication tables? Do you know the first five presidents? Do you know the capitals of all the states? The things that people you know, misconstrue as education. That's not intelligence. I think a big part of intelligence is critical thinking, but a huge part of intelligence is emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's several attributes of emotional intelligence that there's a lot of ways to learn them, but especially for young children, the ability to be able to do free play that a Sudbury environment or a home education environment would allow for can develop some really, really valuable qualities. And one would be self-awareness, the confidence that can come from that, not being controlled by fear or feelings, like recognizing them, but not being ruled by them, you know? From self-awareness, I think you get a kind of self-regulation, being thoughtful, being adaptable, you know, comfortable with change. Being self-assertive is part of self-awareness and self-regulation. Saying what you want. And more importantly, something that people are really bad at, saying what you don't want. Right. You know, the ability to say no. The ability to say, I've had enough, I can't handle anymore, you know, when it comes to like workload or responsibility. Motivation, I would say, is another very important part of emotional intelligence. And we've addressed this already, right? With people like running away from challenges. I think part of motivation in a self-aware person is loving a challenge, finding a challenge, taking pride in their effectiveness with what they do. Things like social skills, empathy, the ability to communicate, to deal with disagreement, to deal with disputes, to maintain relationships. I think that that's a more important foundation than multiplication tables. And that kind of intelligence is not being modeled in the schools at all. You know, I think that the milieu in school is communicating a kind of helplessness for young people. And they've also been like stripped of opportunities to play, or even just to experience themselves in an unstructured way, to be in charge of their own time. More and more and more young people's time has been eaten up in the last 30, 40, 50 years. My parents, or maybe our parents are about the same age, they had to make a total investment in their public education of about 10,000 hours. We probably did 15,000. Mm-hmm. Today, kids are probably doing over 20,000 if you add up all, you know, the homework. I mean, there are kids in elementary school and middle school have multiple hours of homework per night, you know? So the important part of their lives are essentially being stolen from them. Now,
and also starting younger and going later.
Yeah. And at the very least, correlated with the expanding time commitment that young people are forced to make are all of these negative trends. You know, lower academic performance by the school's own metrics, increased diagnosis of mental illness, labels like ADHD, depression, teenage suicide.
Right.
So what's the answer? You know, what's the answer to all these apparent ills of childhood and adolescence? Well, we can go back to 1850 and ask Horace Mann. He'll tell you, more school.
We'll do more. Right.
Do more. Spend more. You know, and that's been the trend. So I think not just giving young people control over their educational experience, but giving them control over their lives, over their time, like as soon as possible. You know, and testing them and letting them test themselves. There's this great author that I would recommend and personality to a lot of your listeners, especially if they have young children. Her name is Lenore Skenazy.
Okay.
And Lenore spelled exactly how it sounds, and Skenazy is Skenezy, I think, or A-Z-Y. And she has a blog called Free Range Kids. Mm-hmm. And she became famous because the mainstream media dubbed her the world's worst mom because she let like her 8 or 9 year old son ride the subway in New York by himself, and not even in Manhattan, maybe in Queens, by himself home from school. And this was found out, and somebody called Child Protective Services. You know, this woman is insane. But this was something that they planned to do, something that they talked about and they prepared for. And then when the time was right, she let her son do this. It wasn't just some haphazard, irresponsible neglect, you know, that led to that happening. But most people don't understand that. They see this world as being incredibly dangerous, you know, and they see young people as being incredibly dangerous and helpless. There's another great author that comes to mind. He's been on my show a couple times. His name is Mike Mayles. He wrote a piece in 1994 when I was a junior in high school, or a senior in high school, junior and senior in high school, called Bashing Youth, Media Myths About Teenagers. And he goes into all of these misconceptions that are being essentially, you know, created by this media fear culture, right, of young people. I think ironically, you know, most people, or a lot of people anyway, too many people, are living in a pretty disconnected world in the 21st century.
Right.
You know, it seems alien and scary. And of course, children are sponges for the attitudes of their parents. But no one knows their neighbors anymore.
Right.
You know? And to know your neighbors, to know your surroundings, I think would lead to a lot of parents not only connecting with people in ways from which their children can benefit, but also feeling safer, you know? And I mean, I remember being six in the 80s and I would just get on my, we lived in a neighborhood and my mom knew everybody. So I would just get on my bike and ride, you know, after school, after first grade. That is something that I could be stolen from her today if that happened, you know, if I was six and I was doing that. The police could come and take me away and put me in foster care. Yeah. By today's standards.
Right. So, and the remarkable thing is that violent crime has dramatically decreased since you were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is actually safer today to do that than it was back then if you go based upon statistics. Now, obviously, you'd have to apply good judgment to where you actually live. But going based upon pure averages, it is safer today to do exactly what you just described than it was when you were doing it. But the perception has dramatically changed. And today, your mom would be locked up. I mean, there's been enough stories of that. She would at least be hauled away. What was that lady that a couple of weeks ago, I don't remember the name, but exactly that thing happened. The kid was playing in the front yard, in her front yard.
Mm.
And she was watching and she was hauled away. It was a horrific story.
I just talked about this with a former Child Protective Services worker on my last show.
Really?
We talked about this very trend and that specific event as well. And it's this combination of obviously a more fearful society. I really blame mainstream media, cable news, really, for that. And also the mission creep of organizations like CPS, you know, always kind of looking for the next thing that they can do, the next people that they can save. Yeah, I think a big part of, you know, moving the whole education conversation forward and creating conditions for better lives for these young kids starts with changes in attitudes. And those changes in attitudes come from people stopping and actually thinking, you know, it's hard, you know, like it's an inheritance, you know, one school generation makes the next school generation.
Right.
And I've seen it close up and personal, you know, in my own family in some ways that really, really bother me. Just things being passed along without thought. And, you know, the question of whether or not I should intervene and how to intervene, right? Because I have a lot to say on these things. And, you know, I see just the kind of thoughtless transmission from the past generation to the next, some of these attitudes towards children. And obviously, I see a lot of things that, you know, my siblings, I think, do better than my parents. But there's certainly not enough of that in the country and around the world. So the change in attitude is very important, and I think it starts with more information. It starts in most information or actual real intelligence starts with definition, right? So school is not education. Those are not synonyms. Education is a lifelong experience. It's not something that you pin down to 6 years, 12 years, 4 years at some, you know, university. It is lifelong. It needs to be self-directed, right? It needs to be intrinsically motivated. So when people ask the question of how will the children be educated, what does that mean? You know, to the person asking the question, does it mean, do you want someone to babysit them while you're at work? Is that what you really mean? Right.
But often it is. That often is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
I like to ask this question to people. And people will often say, oh, you know, I bought this house because it has good schools. Or, you know, we live in, you know, X county instead of Y county because it has better schools. And I like to ask, what makes a good school? And what's remarkable to me is how few of us can answer that question. It's such a big deal. You ask a real estate agent, they tell you this is a big deal. You want to be in a good school district. What is a good school district? Define that for me. And the reason why I think that history is so important, and I'm gonna tie it into inflation here. I'm gonna tie it into finance again to show these threads. And then as we kind of wind down the show, but I like to start with saying, A, what is a good school? Define that.
Yeah.
Because then you have to go back and say, what's your purpose? And here's what I observe. And this the history, I think, is helpful to give this context. But here's what I observe. Ostensibly, I think probably my guess of what the general understanding of the purpose of school would be to prepare students for life skills and job skills. And my proof for that statement would be that generally we're advised to finish high school so that we can get good jobs. Mm-hmm. So what I would take away from that is that we need to finish high school to get good jobs. So therefore, one of the important reasons for schooling is to create good jobs. And then we're often taught that we need to go to college so that we can get a better job. So therefore, one of the important goals of college is supposedly to be able to prepare you for job skills. But if you actually go, so A, not only is that statement there's a lot of hubris to say that you can prepare someone, but I just say, look at the facts. When I graduated from high school, I'm 29 years old. When I graduated high school 11 years ago, the iPod didn't exist.
Right.
The iPhone didn't exist. The entire idea of a smartphone didn't, you know, maybe it existed in somebody's mind, but it wasn't in mainstream.
Right.
Blogs didn't, a little bit existed. Podcasting didn't exist. YouTube YouTube was in its infancy. And I would guess, I can't remember the official statistics, I would guess 50% of the ways that people earn their income today probably were either in their infancy or didn't exist 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So I am a young man. Now, how on earth could you tell me that you could design for me in 12 years an educational curriculum that is supposed to be able to prepare me for the job skills that I need to function in today's environment? So A, that's a prideful statement. B, worse than that, if you actually go and look at the subject matter, none of it is practical as regards job skills. It's generalized knowledge. And then what's the most frustrating thing for me is I feel like the older I get and the more I study, the more I feel like everything I learned in school, either A, I forgot it because even though I was an excellent student, I don't remember it. But B, the things that I do remember turn out to be wildly inaccurate upon a further study.
Mm-hmm.
So I almost feel like I was kind of tricked into thinking that I knew something. And because I felt like I understood why we fought the Revolutionary War and I understood why this happened and why that happened, that then I was kind of satisfied with that instead of going and searching something else out. And so I look at it and I say, to think that I could build for my son the idea that I'm going to give you in a high school curriculum over this 12-year period of time, I'm going to give you what you need to know, in order to succeed in the job market is absurd. And all of the real skills that he needs, skills like social skills, what's the better way to learn social skills? In a class full of sixth graders or spending time with me? So why would I allow my son to be locked up away from me where he can't learn how to actually engage with people and how to engage in conversations and business deals and business skills? Instead, I'm going to lock him up in a room with a bunch of sixth graders where they're going to teach him social skills. I'm sorry, sixth graders are not qualified to teach my children social skills. And neither is the sixth grade teacher is qualified probably in a context of adults, but in a context of sixth graders where they're primarily observing the teacher, that's not the social skills that my son would need to learn.
Yeah.
So it's like everything, if we don't grasp on to the idea of education. And so to me, one of the primary goals is my wife and I talk about what our vision is for our son's education is more than anything, I want to inspire a love of learning. And then I want to teach how to go about the process of learning, how to learn how to learn so that whatever the subject of interest is, that can be, here's how we can use this and become an expert in it. Because that's what we do as adults. And that's what, if we want to be even financially successful, that's what we must do, is we must educate ourselves. And the biggest travesty that happens is that people graduate from school and they feel like, oh, I'm educated.
Yeah.
No, you're schooled. And now you've got to go figure out how to get educated because you didn't learn anything that really mattered, really. I mean, with some, there are exceptions. So at a, you know, maybe in an architecture school is a good example. You know, you need to learn that. But how much quicker if you can learn that from an earlier age? So just define what is the goal of education. And all of a sudden, without even knowing the history, you can start to say, wait a second, this mainstream approach is not necessarily very effective.
The fact that there's a need for this conversation, right? It says a lot about what actually is being taught, or more importantly, not being taught in the public schools and probably in a lot of the private schools. And the most crucial foundation, you definitely said this, and I'll reiterate it, emotional intelligence and critical thinking. Right?
Right.
And I think a lot of the love of learning comes from the attributes of an emotionally intelligent person, right? The motivation, the willingness to accept a challenge, to self-regulate, to accept feedback, all of those things. That's part of the love or enthusiasm for learning. And then the process of actually how to do it, which, you know, we could call critical thinking. On my show, we've talked a lot about the trivium method of critical thinking. Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar I've listened to your four shows that you did on the Trivium, yes, I am familiar with it, but go ahead and give a quick overview for the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I would really just recommend, as a starting point, there's a piece by Dorothy Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S, or maybe there isn't an S, but anyway, the piece is called The Lost Tools of Learning. And this is a guideline, you know, take what you like, leave what you don't, but it provides some guidelines for when is it appropriate to introduce young people to different parts of this process. The trivium, or, you know, trivia, three ways or three paths in Latin, grammar, logic, and rhetoric are the three parts of the trivium. Grammar is essentially the definition, the identification. Something that I've stressed a couple times already is very important, that we define our terms, that there's no point in having a debate if, you know, two people don't know what they're talking about, right? What do you mean by this? What does this mean to you? What is the research that you've done that you bring to this discussion trying to encapsulate this term school? From the grammar, you know, the background knowledge, we move to logic. Which is essentially the removal of contradictions and the integration of that to put things together, to make connections. And the third step of the trivium is rhetoric, the communication or the making useful of the grammar and the logic, you know, the application, the action. And this applies to everything, you know, this input, process, output model is essential in learning. This is a process that our mind wants to go through. School replicates it in many ways. You know, like, I mean, you will do the trivium in school, but this process will never be made explicit. You know, you'll never say, oh, this is the, you'll never be told this is the natural process of your mind, you know, and always remember it. You know, when you're stuck, make sure you're not doing things out of order. Make sure you're not going into it blindly because you don't know all the pieces that you're working with. And a lot of times school works against the trivium. But, you know, the piece that Dorothy Sayers wrote is the lost tools of learning, because they're not explicitly taught in the schools. That's critical thinking. And I think that, you know, good, peaceful parenting sets a beautiful stage for the development of an emotionally intelligent child. And upon that foundation, you know, the process of critical thinking can go. And from there, the sky's the limit for most people, you know. It's those two things that form the foundation of a lifelong education, as far as I'm concerned.
I'd like to close with a final question.
Sure.
Do we need teachers? And if no, you know, why not? And if yes, why? And then if we do, what is a path that somebody as a teacher can take in today's context to be able to teach others?
Okay, well, I would say yes, absolutely. But that's a term that might need redefinition.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the current conception is basically the unionized public school professional or private school or college professor. And it does not need to be that, you know. I think the credentialing of teachers is way out of control. It's almost like it's trying to prevent people. The hoops you need to jump through as far as licensure is concerned. It seems like it's trying to keep ambitious people out of the profession because they don't want to go through all of those demeaning steps. There are people right. who are more than qualified to teach or act as mentors just based on their own experience. You know, I mean, I used to train people to take the certification exams for elementary and early childhood education. Mm-hmm. And it was scary what they didn't know, you know.
Yeah.
Experience is one of the best teachers for sure. We all need mentors, I think. And we live in a world today where people can be teaching you and they don't even know it. You know,
right.
YouTube is full of teachers. Wikipedia, the internet is full of teachers, right? And right. I think it was probably Einstein who talked about that teacher within, right? The most important teacher, which is curiosity. So the idea of the teacher as a person, I think, is something that we're always going to need. But the relationship between teacher and pupil is obviously has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. So how do people position themselves to be teachers today? Well, I would say most importantly, get out there and do something that's valuable and important to you, you know, and share it with people, right? And let other people learn from your experience. Make your experience available somehow, which is getting easier and easier to do. Right? Whether you want to learn how to do DSLR filmmaking or put on your makeup correctly, there's a teacher out there for you for free, right? It's typing a couple keywords into Google or Startpage or YouTube or whatever, you know, and you're there. So we see, and really, like, I remember this whole Wisconsin Union thing that happened in 2011. You see desperate people trying to hold on to a dying profession. Mm-hmm. Right. They don't have that exclusivity. They don't have that monopoly anymore. They're becoming increasingly irrelevant all the time. The same thing is true with college professors, right? College used to be for the elites, right? And now you can go to iTunes University and find and audit, you know, these classes from the best universities in the country, right? You can't get the piece of paper, which is really what you're paying for, but you can get the knowledge. And if you don't want to deal with some crusty old Harvard, you know, leather elbow patch, you know, lefty intellectual type, get a syllabus, you know, mm-hmm. and go find that information for yourself. You know, as long as it's not like economics or something or history of the progressive movement, right? You might want to go elsewhere for those topics. But yeah. So it's a difficult question to answer, but I hope I've provided people at least maybe a slightly new way of thinking about it.
And the reason I picked it there is because one of the biggest issues that's important to me is that people, we have concepts in our mind. So for example, if you say I'm anti-school, then people hear that as probably one of two things. I'm anti-education.
Yep.
Actually, one of three things. I'm anti-education, I'm anti-academics, mm-hmm. or I'm anti-teacher. And so I am anti-school, but I think education is, how do we grow if we don't have an education? And I think academic excellence is incredibly important. And I think teachers are, how do you learn without a great teacher? But the system in which those things can exist is so much more, can be so much better. And there are so many amazing teachers, and both within the school, within the formal school system and without. I'm one of those people. I thought about teaching. And recently, so what happened is, you probably don't know, I shut down my financial planning practice in order to start this show because I couldn't do it as a financial advisor because of the licensing restrictions on, and basically the limitations on my profession around marketing. Any kind of public communication would be marketing if I were to speak to the public. So I couldn't do it. So I had to close down a business that I'd spent 6 years building to do this show.
Wow.
But the reason that I did it is because I said, nobody is teaching financial planning. nobody's doing a good job of it teaching financial planning. So I said, I'm going to go teach it. Well, I needed a way to fund the transition because I didn't want to spend all my savings on some, you know, extremely uncertain, you know, who knows, I may never make a dime on this.
Right,
I'm hoping that it can support me, but it may never actually go. So I needed a job. I thought about going and teaching because there's a high school right near my house. And I thought, oh, I'll go teach economics. I love history. I like economics. I have a master's degree. You know, I'll go and this would be easy. I'm like, I don't want to go through this certification process and I got to go take classes on instruction. I said, this is pointless. And then I'm going to get stuck into the system. So you have, I mean, this is not egotistical, but frankly, I'm highly qualified to be a teacher in terms of academic credentials, but I don't want to go and deal with that system. But there's no reason for me not just to start teaching. So I started a show and I started teaching. And this is the opportunity that exists because we as a teacher, I believe I will inspire more people to become financial planners and more financial planners to elevate their game and inspire more people to want to learn about finance because I love the subject. And this is one of the most valuable things that a teacher can do if a teacher is great. But I think back to when in eighth grade, I had a dear teacher. She was a wonderful lady, but she was teaching about Shakespeare. And I'm just, you know, I'm looking at it saying, this is just stupid. I don't care about Shakespeare. Recently, I found somebody who was talking about Shakespeare. You know who? I think it may have been Gatto. No. It was something. He was talking about the history of Shakespeare and like the impact of the rhyme and the rhythm of it and the specific stress and this art form. Mm-hmm. And I found myself so fascinated that I'm like, I got to go find a Shakespeare podcast and learn about Shakespeare because, you know, everyone says he's great. But I had this mediocre experience because I didn't have a teacher with passion. And if you're a teacher working inside the school system, keep it up because some of the teachers, meaning keep it up in the sense that ignore the system and help your students because you can make a direct impact on those that you're there. And we need that. And if you're outside, start teaching. And if you're inside, start teaching those who are outside. Because over the next 20 years, I'm convinced that there's an opportunity for world-class teachers to just teach about what they care about. Mm-hmm. And even to the point where, like, physical proximity, it's easy to wax on and on about how great the internet is. But you know what? There are times when the internet's not enough.
Right.
And so more and more, if I could go to – I was looking recently at the programs for the Chautauqua up in New York where they do these summer programs. And I'd heard about that and I was like, wow, that's interesting. So I'm looking at their course curriculum and thinking, wow, how fun would it be to go and take 3 weeks in the summer and go and get a chance to study with a world-class expert on a specific subject. And I find myself doing that and people are organizing conferences and organizing seminars and organizing week-long classes. And so like all of these things that school has bastardized and kind of taken over, like we still need them, but within the context of free will, of interest and of passion and of desire to learn, and then the ability to do it on a voluntary basis. I mean, the results are so much more remarkable, at least in my observation. So that's, I mean, we need great teachers. This is not anti-teacher.
Right.
This is anti-school in the control sense. You know, and like, I think a lot about academic rigor. Mm-hmm. And academic rigor and academic excellence is extremely important to me for my son, and we're hoping to have more kids. But like, that's extremely important to me to have academic excellence. But yet, that there's a difference, and I think I can inspire that. I think I can inspire that through example and through inspiration. And I do think that I have, and feel free to disagree. I'm not sure if you do it agree or not, but I feel that I, as a parent, I have a responsibility to inspire the direction of my, I don't see it as a hands-off thing as far as saying, son, you just go and do whatever you want all day.
Mm-hmm.
My job is to inspire and to expose and then to watch the individual characteristics of my son develop.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people's expectations and you know, desires for what they want to see in their children should really be limited to what they as parents can model, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up around a lot of dads who were putting their kids into hockey. And man, did they want to be hockey players when they were teenagers, you know? And damn it, Junior was going to carry it out.
right,
you know,
right.
for them. And obviously, you can, you know, add the sport of your choice to that example. But parents wanting to live whatever it is vicariously through the children or correct their mistakes through their children, if they can't model it, it's just going to, it's not going to have positive results. It's going to be a strained relationship. And I think in most cases, a failure in one way or another, even if the child achieves what the parent wants, you
right.
know, is that their will? Is that the child or the teenager's will to achieve that? Seldom is the answer yes.
Right.
So I think, yeah, that's really important. And just on something that you said earlier, you know, every time I post something new, in the next 24 hours, it reaches as many people as I could have reached through traditional teaching in 10 or 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I couldn't have had more than 200 students a year that I could imagine in any public school setting. So the great thing about that is not just the new technology that makes that possible. It's that every single one, like let's just say I post something and in the first 24 hours, 2,000 people see it. 10 to 20 years of public school students coming and going, mm-hmm. you know? The beautiful thing is that of those 2,000 people came to it voluntarily. No
right.
one is being forced to listen to it. And that's, you know, that's one of the best things for making real education happen. The choice, you know,
right.
The desire, the intrinsic motivation. I couldn't ask for that out of 25 of the 200 students that I might have had in 1 year as a public school teacher. And I remember working in private school and really, really having to focus on the 3 kids in my class who were engaged mm-hmm. in some way. That made me feel effective. Yeah, it's an exciting world for this concept of teaching. And
right.
People just have to be flexible, I think, with what that means today.
Right. Wow, Brett, I really appreciate your being willing to come and talk about these things. And it's such a challenging subject to work through in today's world because there's so much emotion around it.
Yeah.
And I hope that I believe we have succeeded this, you know, this morning in kind of laying out maybe just some thoughts and some ideas. And I would encourage people, you know, hopefully use this as a jumping off point. And I never was exposed to any of these concepts. You know, I wish I had been exposed earlier. And it was through a very circuitous path that I started to be exposed to some of these ideas and some of the research that's been done. But I hope that this would just simply be a jumping off point for people to go and do their own research, because this is such an important area. It's too important to not, you know, to not dig deeper. And I would encourage people to do that. If in an audio format, your show is an awesome resource for people. It's called the School Sucks Podcast, right? So
yep.
you can find it everywhere. It's a schoolsucksproject.com, right?
Schoolsucksproject.com. And if people are, you know, looking for a couple of shortcuts, right? We all have those
right.
habits. We want to get through things quickly. You can search by series. So if there's some particular educational or historical topic that you're interested in, you can get right to it. There is a YouTube channel that we have. It's called School Sucks Podcast. That's our username on YouTube. And I do this series of videos based on the underground history of American education, this book we've been talking about by John Taylor Gatto, where I'm just taking excerpts from that massive book and turning them into 5 to 10 minute videos that hopefully when all is said and done, will tell at least part of the story from that book. So if people want to see what Gatto's writing is like, what my work is like, that's an interesting place, hopefully an entertaining place to start. It's called The Best of John Taylor Gatto, or The Underground History of American Education on the School Sucks YouTube channel.
Right. And his work is so good. It's so challenging.
Absolutely. And I think I really like his writing. Some people don't, but I really do. And I really find it like entertaining. I like his sense of humor. And
right.
Unfortunately, the book, a lot of his books are just way too obscure, you know, considering
right.
how mainstream I would like them to be. So that was why I tried to bring some of it to the young YouTube audience. And
right.
hopefully
right.
those videos will continue to get views there.
Right. Awesome. Brett, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. Keep up the good work. Keep up enlightening people with your message and teaching people. I appreciate everything that you do.
Well, my pleasure, Joshua. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation. It's been almost 2.5 hours. It flew by.
All right. I'll have to figure out whether I'm going to release this as one or split it up into two, but it was really good.
Cool. Well, again, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.